Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves and this is a podcast I recorded earlier with Professor Joe Haslam, who is just ending the first week of lockdown in Madrid. Regular listeners to the podcast would know Joe. He's contributed a few times, but he's also did his master's in disaster recovery planning, and he knows about this stuff. It is a great listen. With a guy who really knows, he's been to all of these places, Venezuela, he's just back from Mexico, he's travelled the globe to see how societies bounce back and how we can learn and make sure that we put what is important at the heart of what we do. Bit of housekeeping, just subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts, but also keep an eye out for our other podcasts that we have on the network. We have Disturbing the Peace this week has a brilliant episode with Tate Donnelly of the Greens, who was the youngest candidate in the recent general election, which seems like a million years ago. Reboot Republic, Rory Hearn's podcast, has two pods out this week with Dahi Downey of Dublin City Council and Orla Hegarty, UCD, our School of Architecture. Two short pods, great stuff on the housing crisis, and we are also launching two new pods in the coming days, which is probably a bit mad given the circumstances, but I'm currently working with two fantastic people. Dr. Caroline West has amazing stuff lined up, and she has real insights into the aspects of sexual health, well-being and sexual health and things that I can't even say without getting red around the ears. So I'm really looking forward to helping Caroline get that off the ground. And Ewan McKenna is going to be doing his new podcast, The Black Eye, and that will be coming shortly. If you could, please join us. We need support. We're simply not viable. We are committed to doing this, but we need people to help us out. It's we just use the Patreon model. There's no sponsors. There's no ads. There's no anything else. It's just us in a room. So if you could head over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack, there's a range of options in there. Show how you can come on board. Every cent will help. Thanks for listening. Talk to you all soon.
I'm delighted to be joined on the line by our friend in Madrid, Professor Joe Haslam. Joe, how are you?
Very good, Tony. I'm very good. I'm here in central Madrid. I think it's day six of the lockdown. We started on Sunday. Mm. So I'm here with my wife and my two kids who are like age 10 and 12. So we're all basically we've been on lockdown. I haven't left the house. My wife does leave the house to do the shopping. We're both lucky in that we can work from home. I've been teaching online classes and doing that.
Yeah.
And my wife similarly. So and nobody from our family has been affected or been sick or anything. So in a sense, we're okay. That doesn't in any way mean that we're sort of making light of the crisis. We've just been lucky. But we're very aware of what's going on. I mean, the second largest hospital in Europe is just across the road from us. And while we don't know what's going on in there, it is a reminder. And of course, at 8 o'clock every evening, everyone goes out onto their balconies to kind of clap and give a round of applause for the things that are being made, the contribution being made by the health workers. And it's quite incredible. Some of them have died, just like in China. And whatever about anything else that your profession could cause you to die, I mean, that is an incredible sacrifice. That's like, fighting a war, going in an army, being shot.
Actually, I'm glad you brought that up, Joe, because we know Spain is going through a difficult time. The lockdown, as you said, is 6 days on. The surge or the spike has been quite on a trajectory equal to, if not, worse than Italy in some regards. And to see the healthcare workers, and then we see in Ireland, 84 of the people currently with positive tests are healthcare workers. So they are really the front line of this. And, it is, people are starting to use the language of it's a war on coronavirus or a war on COVID-19. So I'm glad you brought it up. And it does almost shape what we wanted to speak about, though, the things that matter versus the things that don't matter. And nothing has put that in context more so than what's been going on with this crisis. When we were speaking during the week about things, you made the point to me that this will bring home to people, what actually has value and what doesn't.
The question is, like, will this be different, you know, and which crisis do you compare back to? I mean, you obviously have, you know, the Great Wars. I mean, history has always had moments of resetting, you know. Mm-hmm. In other words, that either historically it's been a war rather than, you know, actual combat war where you know, everything from conscription to people, although, I mean, we saw what happened in Syria and stuff, but you know, ourselves, we haven't really been touched. And it's just one of those things that I've always been aware of. I mean, I teach students from up to 100 nationalities where, you know, they always used to laugh about the complacency of Europe and the fact that, you know, we in the classroom would be like optimizing every circumstance, you know, this kind of just in time. And, you know, we had people from the Ukraine, from Zimbabwe, from Syria, Lebanon particularly, and they used to laugh at the way that, you know, some of these case studies we were teaching about the idea that you would, you know, have to have stock resting on a shelf for 3 hours when you could optimize the you know, these, they just said life isn't like that, you know. And they always used to sort of laugh as well about the complacency in which we would treat the rule of law. Like the idea that you know, we just took it for granted that you know, we would always have low inflation, we would always have courts that would enforce decisions, we would never have civil unrest. And they used to say, you know, you talk to someone from Argentina, you talk to someone from these countries, and they would sort of say that it's in moments like that when you understand who actually does value, that in moments of, you know, the people that we worshipped in society were very much these kind of, you know, we'll call them wealth creators, or these kind of predatory capitalist people who are always doing clever things like car parks or Airbnb or you know, getting points or day trading. And they were sort of going, well, when the crisis hits, people who grow food, who can fix cars, you know, those kind of things suddenly become very important. And I always just remember those kind of conversations because I tended, you know, I traveled about 20 weeks a year. I was in Mexico for the last 2 weeks. And, you know, these are the conversations you have with people. And I don't think this crisis will be like before. I think there will be a more of a reevaluation in society and understanding that not just frontline services, because some people say that, but just in general, who are the kind of the people who create things and add value, and who are the people that just kind of live off the transaction in between? And I think there'd be a great revaluation. I mean, the words we, you know, resilience, stability, well-being, sustainability, those kind of things will become much more important. And you know, wealth creation and predatory capitalism and those kind of things will be just seen as literally, like, you know, smoking or those kind of things, just not polite to mention in society.
I think it's a really good point because, you know, after the last crisis, the global financial crisis, it was a rebalancing in a way of the financial services industry, and the banks were saved at all costs. And we looked at how this was done, and we've seen, you know, I saw statistics where people were showing about, I think it was to the tune of that the German and French banks sorted out their balance sheets to over €1 trillion within 18, 24 months by divesting themselves of, you know, Portuguese, Spanish, Greek and Irish bonds, basically by using the Troika. This won't be similar to that, I don't think, at all. I think there's going to be a heavy price in terms of, you know, buying bonds and bailing out people. I mean, even Trump is talking about helicopter money and $1,000 per month. You made the point when we talked earlier about seeing the most unusual of people now becoming allies.
Yeah, there's that great phrase about, you know, everyone sort of, oh, that's what I always believed. Like, we all now believe in sustainable communities and, you know, we all believe in climate change. But, you know, you do see and like the pollution levels over China, everything from like dolphins swimming around the, you know, Venice, all these kind of things that we see. And once something becomes possible, you know, then you sort of, it's a great advantage entrepreneurs often have of seeing something work in another country and then bringing it to the other country, because when they've seen that it works, it gives them the confidence to persevere, even if you know, user acceptance. And I think that's, those kind of things are going to be, we're going to find other ways to do things. And then it'll kind of become, I don't know why we didn't always do this, you know. And I think that the other thing, of course, is that because we bailed out the banks, we, of course, added greatly to debt. And that debt hasn't gone away. And so I don't think those solutions are as open to us as before. So I don't know what we're going to do. I mean, there's, you know, helicopter money is being discussed. And I think that, I mean, that's not a completely new idea. And it has, you know, it's taken place in Hong Kong. It's taken place in different places. I mean, I have my doubts about, like, it's a bit like the children's allowance debate, you know, like, should everyone get it? And although you talk to people who say that, yeah, it should, and it would certainly be an effective way of doing something relatively fair and quickly. So on that basis, I think that has to happen. You know, I don't think that can be the only solution. But the issue about the issue about debt and the issue about what we're going to do if like 50% of people could lose their jobs, you know, a lot of things are going to kind of come down very quickly. And I think we need to talk about what effects that those have. And I think a lot of people need to be very honest with themselves and not try and fight to keep something. It's a bit like when you have these kind of crisis situations very often. I mean, the building I live in, I mean, the neighbors, we sort of salute each other on the corridors, but we don't ever really get into any great conversation. But then when something happens in the building, we all kind of come together and we discuss what skills we have. And someone says, oh, I'm a solicitor, I can do this, or I'm a carpenter. And I think there's going to be more of those kind of solutions where we have to kind of come together and work out collectively rather than, you know, not having that kind of relationship. Now, if that sounds idealistic and utopian, it's, you know, I put it to you that actually that's what happens in, you know, Chile and Zimbabwe and the Ukraine and stuff like that. And that, you know, people ask, like, what kind of skills do you have that are useful? Good with your hands and these kind of things, and funny enough as that might sound, you know, I think there's going to be a very much an element to that returning.
I think that's like you've made some very, like, there's, you made a lot of points there. So obviously we've seen things in terms of how this is going to clarify climate change in many people's minds, because they've seen when this, you know, the last time we had a reduction in global CO2, it was around the global financial crisis, and we've just seen it, you know, spiral out of control. This will show that, you know, action can happen and nature will come back quickly. It shows that we don't all need to go to New York every Christmas to do our shopping for a few clothes and things like that. I do think that there are, you know, there's a lot of learnings that can be taken. I also want to ask you, you're not just coming up with this. You did a master's in crisis management, so you do know what you're talking about. You've been to Venezuela, these places that they now use as the bogeyman.
Well, look, I'm always reluctant to talk about my master's, which was like over 20 years ago. But I mean, you know, I did it on disaster recovery planning, and you know, the big thing that find is that in a disaster, you need to build in resilience. It isn't just one thing that can kind of kill you. It's three or four things happening together that causes the problem. And that, again, is sort of what we're going to start seeing, which is to say, maybe, okay, if like there's two people working in the house, maybe if one person loses their job, you can kind of get through it. But if two people lose their job and the school's shut and your car stops working, it's the cumulative factor that really causes trouble. And that's about the only thing you really need to know about disasters. All of the major disasters in the world, from like BP to Chernobyl, it was the things happening together that caused the problem. People could perhaps have survived one or two things, but it was things happening together. And again, that's kind of, you know, what I might see, hear about, you know, medicines not arriving, just a general sort of complacency about, you know, something will always be there. And then suddenly when it's not, you're looking around for solutions, and you only have one way of doing something. You know, so that's what will change. And I think that we will start to kind of, you know, have to rely on each other rather than just the idea that all you had to do in life was get money. Mm. And if you had money, then everything was possible. That was sort of the way, the attitude we'd have. But it, what they learn in crisis societies is, you know, whether it's, you know, I've mentioned them many times, is that actually in a crisis, money is the most useless thing in the world. And it's what you can do in terms of, can you fix a car? Can you grow vegetables? You know, do you have kind of old remedies? You know, you have all of the kind of old people who use plants and grind them up in pestles and mortars. And these are the kind of things that come out. And again, there will be people laughing at me as I talk about this. But this is what I hear from my students, that in these kind of situations where money becomes effectively useless, that's when you start to learn, you know, resilience. And again, my wife's grandmother is 95 and she lives next door to us. Mm. Just not uncommon in this part of the world. Yeah. And, you know, she's fine, like, because suddenly everyone is kind of, she's talking about the days of the war and how survived and this kind of thing, you know. And it's very funny to, very fun, like, people are saying, how are you coping? How are you coping? And she was like, I lived, like, 30 years of my life like this, you know. Mm. And it's, the other thing is, I mean, I don't want to go on about entrepreneurs as being this kind of super species, but, you know, there's an element, if you're an entrepreneur, and you can relate to this, that, you know, some months you don't get paid. And, you know, my wife has always worked for a company and always gets a salary at the end of the month. So she, if that didn't happen, she, it's just, that's built into her mental model. But I always say that in business, the number one thing that it surprises people is that you don't get paid on time. Yeah. So in a sense, kind of having to deal with that and manage that and is something that a lot of entrepreneurs have had to deal with anyway, so they can perhaps cope better than others.
I want to go back on something you said about the combination of things. And I remember, I can't remember where I read it, but talking about some of the extinction level events that we talk about through the history of the world, how it's often not the first shock to the system that wipes out something, it's the second. And this is the second in a decade later in many ways. And this also, you know, when we talk about recalibration and the fact that money cannot be the be all and end all. Many people have said before that this is the death of neoliberal capitalism and been proven wrong. But I think this may actually be the one that changes things in terms of giving people a different perspective to say that actually, you know, quality of life, a roof, you know, secure, adequate housing, and a reasonable standard of living are actually more important. Especially when you think of, I don't know if you saw the Taoiseach's address to the nation and how he put this speech forward, and everybody, he got lauded as this for this terrific speech, and you know, it was a good speech. I wouldn't say it wasn't, but only last night we heard from on prime time from a doctor who said we have less than half the European average in ICU beds. So it's you know, it's all well and good giving speeches, but if that model of the market will fix it hasn't delivered for us, you know, that's, we need to get away from that rapidly.
Yeah, well, I think what's been interesting is like, and I mean, I'm of the age where people I went to school with are TDs, and not going to give you any names. Some of them, you know, what sort of surprised me is that, you know, and this is before COVID had come in, but even after the reaction with the last election, like a lot of them were, even after the, you know, we always said that, you know, people in Fine Gael defended the market as a solution to everything because that was ultimately what the people wanted. In other words, there was always this belief that if house prices stayed high, people had the wealth effect and would continue to vote for the status quo. So even what surprised me was that even after the, you know, the Sinn Féin surge and that they were still defending the market. You know, it's a bit like, you know, not to use football analogies, but, you know, it's like even after this guy has given away 3 goals, you're still defending that, oh, he's great going forward, you know, that kind of thing. So I think that's sort of what surprises me. But, I mean, Leo's instinct is always to do nothing, you know. That's always been his thing, you know. And I understand in the speech that you do have to urge calm. And he's an excellent communicator. And as a doctor, he should be in familiar terms. And, you know, I'd rather have him than Boris and stuff. But you have to back it up, you know. A speech buys you time, but, you know, you have to try and give people like a vision of things eventually getting better. And I don't think he has quite done that yet. And I don't know whether he comes out with it or other people come out with it. But, you know, it's a bit like Rahm Emanuel's, you know, a crisis is too good an opportunity to waste.
Yeah.
But, you know, those kind of things about, listen, you know, developer levies, all of these things that are brought in always have like a 5-year moratorium. And a lot of that stuff will have to, no, we have to have that now. It's... you know, it's now unacceptable to have like serviced land that you don't build on, or it's now unacceptable to kind of not to give people contracts and these kinds of, you know, we have to go back to the fundamental basic things about having a stable society and literally not having people, you know, there was a thing in The Onion, which I am still a fan of, you know, conservative defends ideas, even if it means riots on streets, you know.
And
there's an element of that coming. And again, I mean, the third time I've said this, because it's the number one thing I hear, which is like, people always believe it can never happen to them. But this whole thing is really fragile. Like the basis in which we take 40% of people's money, we imprison people, we accept the you know police actions. Like the whole basis in which the thing is organized is very fragile. And the distance as to which it says, when this works for me, people will accept it. But the distance after which, you know, not so much storming the Bastille and all that kind of things, but you know, we can all be, again, the history of these things happening in other places tells us that the distance from between when the system works for you, the way you behave, and when the system stops working for you. Now, that's not to bring in, like, there are always people on both extremes who kind of urge things. And I do often say that, you know, stability has its value. But I think the point at which people start to defend kind of ideas just because they don't want to look bad, that was what surprised me about the last election. There was the idea that you can defend the indefensible, and that you can you know, the other thing of course is that everyone is 10 years older, and there's a, you know, my classes online have never been so vital, because people like kind of are like, there is no way we're letting this happening again. You know, these kind of things. So, you know, people say, is it hard to teach online? And I'm like, no, the computer is exploding, because now everyone has a voice and an opinion. And people before that were kind of, people said kind of trust us. And they trusted them. And all that happened was, you know, that the inequality continued to grow. And I don't think people are going to let that happen again.
I think, again, a couple of things there. Amazing to see how, when you talk about how a widening, you know, that model widened inequality, a widening inequality in society, and we were told X things can't be done, you know, we can't have rent freezes, we can't have this, we can't have that, and all of a sudden we can have these things now. They're you know, the bureaucracy is falling away. And then worryingly, and I mean this worryingly, where as an Irish citizen, there the government formation talks between the Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael conversation. The quotes that came out of a meeting last night where Fine Gael, it will be back to us again to rebuild the economy. And I, again, you know, if that's the quote you're bringing out about rebuilding the economy, nothing, it's just, you know, we have to learn the lesson that people want to live in a society and not live in an economy. And it just, it's just, I don't know if the message is getting through, and that would concern me as here in Ireland, that you know, you've been rejected by the electorate, and now we're in the middle of this crisis, and the one thing we don't need is for everybody to come around and say, well, what we need now is another rake of economic promises, and go back into the stuff that's repeatedly failed us.
Which is, Tony, what will happen is, like, if all the pillars fall together, you know, that's when it starts to get difficult. So if you, you know, like everything from Ireland has really, you know, we have very low levels of entrepreneurship, and in particular, we've low levels of family entrepreneurship, which is the basis for most entrepreneurship, because we basically rely on the multinationals. Like, and the idea that, you know, that sort of stuff is starting to go away. You know, even Facebook, their whole business model is based on the fact that, you know, they accept money from everyone to say anything. And they're now showing that actually they can stop a lot of that stuff if they wanted to. And they're being forced to do it. So, and even I think a lot of the multinationals will have to get, will have to return to base effectively. And, you know, though, like all of that is going to change. So you had to defend this kind of thing that everyone had a buy to let. You know, you had a good job based on, you had a 4x4, as you say, shopping in Dubai and New York, which is a particular kind of, you know, thing that I just couldn't understand. You know, even taking cocaine at the weekends, those kind of stuff, you know, I mean, you know, like it's all of those things could potentially go away. And so I at that point, whatever about one of those, and we'll go. I mean, if you look at Airbnb, Madrid is the one I know, but you know, it's been crashing. You know, I mean, there's sort of, now I know people are sort of, Ronan Lyons was talking about, he has access to the numbers, and he's urging kind of, don't get too excited too quickly. But certainly in Spain, you know, it was at what was $1,000 euros a month is now 600. You know, a lot of people are starting to realize that, you know, nobody, for both health reasons and for money reasons, people are the great Airbnb thing. And this is what it should have been. Like, Airbnb should have been, there is a place for Airbnb. I mean, you know, a lot of conferences couldn't take place without them. But this idea of this idea that it would be bigger than the hotel sector or these kind of things, that was never what was meant to happen. And you can say that about a lot of these businesses. Like, WeWork is a good business to a certain extent, but the idea that you need seven WeWorks is what's wrong. And Facebook, similarly, is an interesting business to an extent, but they are a publisher and they should be regulated like a publisher. So a lot of these businesses should never have been let, because when you're consuming the ecosystem, I mean, eventually the ecosystem kind of falls over. So I think a lot of these kind of businesses and are, you know, I can't see over the medium term, they're just going to let me just say something I've said before, which is anything that grows quickly can fall apart quickly. And that's what nature tells us. So I think a lot of these businesses that have grown very quickly, I think will fall apart just as quickly.
Last thing, Joe, for me, just in terms of bringing it back to outside your front door, it's a state of emergency. We've seen it in France where people are being stopped and fined on the spot if they don't have their paperwork for why they're out and about. What are you thinking in terms of the time frame on this? Are we another 24 days before that's reviewed, or are we just, as how long is a piece of string on this?
Yeah, well, the first thing is, I mean, they had to shut everything down to understand the nature of the problem. I mean, again, that's the first kind of, you can't begin to you know, what gets measured gets done. You can't fix the problem until you know what it is. So they had to do that. I think everything will be shut until Easter, just because there's a psychological kind of thing about that. Yeah. And then after that, it's a question of is the capacity in the system? And I think what we'll have is, certainly I've traveled around China, I've traveled around parts of Africa, you know, they have a kind of a gun and they take your temperature and they don't let you on the plane. They don't let you, literally that's what's happening. They're walking around and saying that if your temperature is above a certain thing, you have to self-isolate. You know, whether we'll get into these kind of apps that literally then a government, you know, they take your temperature on. Now, again, you're laughing, but like, this is, you know, this.
I'm only laughing because I've spoken to Dr. Paul O'Brien, who's dealt with, is a China analyst, and he it's very clear how these things have actually worked. It's like this, this has worked.
They scan you. If your temperature is above a certain thing, they take your telephone number, mm-hmm. and then they put that into the system, and then you're tracked in terms of your self-isolating. And then if you don't self-isolate, you get like a fine and, mm-hmm. you know, all this kind of stuff. And that's what will happen. Because there should be an emphasis on getting everything moving again. Now, it'll help us in Spain that the weather will get a bit better in terms of temperature-wise. And I think also, I mean, that's the other thing about, the public health system will have to bring in extra capacity, and it will have to have, like, excess capacity, which is something that they kind of never had. So, but that's the future, that we'll be in lockdown until at least Easter, and then they'll have a situation whereby, unless you're showing symptoms, if you're showing symptoms, you have to self-isolate and maybe even talk about people you're in contact, and then they will start taking temperatures, and they will start letting people circulate who don't have any symptoms. And that's ultimately, maybe we'll have kind of tests that are a bit like pregnancy tests rather than tests that are, involve lab work and things like that.
Yeah.
And I think also, but I think it'll be like 18 months, you know, whether there's genetic components, everything from people's BMI, I mean, is going to be a factor. There's going to be like an algorithm which says, you know, if your BMI is greater than this and you're this age and you have this temperature and whatever, then like computer says no. I mean, that's. I'm sorry. That's where we're going.
Yeah. No. And look, in many ways, as you've seen with the likes of what has happened successfully in China, some of this we'll learn these lessons and we will hopefully move on. And you know, I saw Paddy Cosgrave yesterday with the 60,000 PPE equipment for the doctors and medics, the masks and the face guards and these things. You know, all of this, we do think we should learn from this, build resilience and make sure that we actually don't accept, where we look at our statistics and know. I've seen the document before this crisis hit, where the Irish Hospital Consultants Association had asked for 550 ICU beds and had been granted 240. And this is before this entire debacle or crisis hit. So, you know, we do need a rebalancing. And I do think that that technology is going to play a part. And I know you said I was laughing, but I was only laughing on the basis that, you know, the Chinese state were able to, they do own Huawei and were able to, influence that as a way of doing real.
Let me just say something about Paddy, and you know, I've had my own dealings with him, and he's always been great. That he has every right to articulate. You know, I mean, he doesn't have to be right 100%. It's his job to keep pressure on people, and you know how he does it. The other thing is that you know he meets like to people in China. Paddy Cosgrave is Ireland, you know, the who's Leo Varadkar kind of stuff, you know. This is the thing you forget about Paddy. You think he's just a guy in an Aaron jumper, but, you know, he meets prime ministers. He's met the head of Hong Kong. He has these contacts. And in that sense, if you can do something, and if someone calls you, and offers you this stuff, then of course you should do it. So, I mean, but it is Paddy's job to keep the pressure up on people, because the great, every crisis we've had in Ireland, the report subsequently has identified groupthink as being the reason why the thing didn't happen. And that's the financial crisis, that's everything, right? So the thing about Paddy is that he isn't a conventional thinker. And that, in that sense, his input is very valued. And I don't agree with everything he says. But, you know, in that sense, I think keeping the pressure on people and people, you know, it's what's that famous saying? Like, you know, those who can't do shouldn't get in the way of people who can do. Yeah. And let's face it, if there's masks in the thing. But I'm okay with Paddy. You know, I think he in that sense. I mean, I in that sense, he's quite okay, and I think he has to hold people to account, and what he says matters outside of this country, so people can't ignore him.
I agree with you on the fact that like his where Ireland is a small like man with the population of Manchester, but his reach is big, and I'm grateful that he brought any of that influence to bring in equipment that helps save lives. So we so for what it's worth, and I know he listens to the podcast, so there you go, Paddy. Thanks so much for that. Joe, look, we will stay in touch and see how you get on over the next few weeks, and we hope for you and your family that everything passes smoothly. Mind yourself, please.
Okay, stay safe, and all the best to you and Martin as well, Tony. Okay,
oh, yeah, he's bye-bye. We have him locked away for a while longer anyway. Cheers. Cheers, Joe. Talk bye. To you soon. Bye.